This is Kate Scott Allen of Otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
This episode of Herding Code is brought to you by RunScope Traffic Inspector. It's like Fiddler or Postman, but it's up in the cloud. So that allows you to get a live stream of the API requests that your applications are making. The cool thing is that it's set up as an HTTP endpoint. So that means you can just toggle the HTTP endpoint in your application without making any code changes. And that works with any language or any framework. You can sign up for free at runscope.com/herdingcode and get a free standard account. That's a $29 a month value. RunScope, everything is going to be 200 okay. Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded September 9th, 2014. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. It's been a little while. We all kind of took a summer break and then kind of lost each other's phone numbers, and we're getting the band back together. And also, in the interest of full, complete honesty, Scott Kuhn is going to join us at some random time, like the Spanish Inquisition. And so, Kevin, what have you done? What's new? What have you been up to? You're all Mr. Node now. Still.
Oh yeah. No, I've been still doing the Node thing. We're working for a startup in San Francisco called Brandcast. And we're still doing our thing. Tons of JavaScript, front end, back end, JavaScript all the time. Pretty much what I've been working on.
Still MongoDB?
Still MongoDB, yep. So yeah, but I've also been sort of running the development process there. So I kind of split my time between coding and managing and, planning the product and all that kind of stuff.
What does a development process look like in a Node JavaScript world? Like, I mean, is there anything hugely different? It's all Git and
no.
It's the same old stuff?
Yeah, pretty much. It's Git. We're, pretty standard kind of Scrum kind of stuff. So yeah, it's not that different from what you might expect.
What's the front end framework du jour?
Oh yeah, we're old school. We keep it old
still
school.
Backbone. I remember this one.
Yes, with a whole bunch of our own stuff layered on top of it.
Cool. And then, do you mess with any like side project stuff? Or is that enough to keep your brain fully occupied?
Man, I have not been for quite some time, actually. The other thing I did this summer is we moved, not very far, just about 10 miles east, but between buying a house, moving, settling in, and selling the old house, it's like I have no time for anything. I mean, the house is still half unpacked.
Yeah.
So you're still in the Bay Area?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Not too far.
Cool. All right, K. Scott, what's new for you?
Also, a lot of JavaScript, a lot of front-end JavaScript, and MongoDB is still there, but sandwiched in between is C# and MVC and Web API and stuff like that.
Are you still Angularing?
Still Angularing. Still.
Just yes, say yes.
Still using that quite a bit. It's late. Lose the ability to enunciate.
And is that, I remember you were talking about, like, a lot of this was healthcare related, like you were doing document database stuff with, And that's still going well? Because I remember earlier on you were talking about like some, maybe this will work or maybe that won't work kind of stuff.
Well, stuff is working and in production, but there does seem to be problems that crop up every week. Some are performance problems. As we've gotten to some of the larger clients that have more data, things have been taking too long. So actually I spent a lot of time this week, and some of it wasn't the database layer. Actually, some of it was C# code. I spent like 2 days this week with JetBrains profiler
dot trace.
Just trying to find hotspots and then redoing algorithms, and found a lot of O(n)³ action going on.
Wow.
And then the last problem actually is pretty interesting. It was MongoDB has a 16 megabyte limit for a document.
Right.
We're trying to store all the information about an inpatient visit, an outpatient visit in a single document, which is usually pretty easy. I haven't gone through to see, what the average patient size is, but most people who are inpatients in a hospital are there for a few days or a week, maybe. One place where we installed was a children's hospital that had a patient there for 11 months, and they had something like 250,000 lab tests during that period.
Wow.
And that doesn't fit in 16 megabytes. So that is a bit of a stickler.
Wow. Yeah, I was even wondering, I mean, do you store, like, does it just store references out? Like, do you store binary stuff, like, I don't know, x-rays or things like that? Or is this just kind
of
notes?
No, it's mostly just sets of medical codes. So every procedure that happens to someone, every diagnosis, every medication they're given boils down to some code. And so it's mostly just sets of codes. But then, of course, it's hard to join in Mongo. So you end up storing descriptions and all sorts of other things in the same collection. And that can make it a little bit larger.
And I know you'd looked at Redis a long time ago. I remember one of your blog posts was helpful as I was learning it. Is that, do you have any kind of caching front end kind of thing, or is it all just Mongo everywhere and you're just optimizing, you know, like writing to multiple sets in Mongo?
It is still a lot of caching, and Redis currently not playing a role. The caching is mostly all these algorithms that we have to run over the data we'll do with MapReduce and then just store new collections with that data. So it doesn't have to happen at report time.
And it doesn't sound like, just from watching all your various social media outpourings, that I don't think you're traveling a whole lot lately. Is that true?
Not as much. I tried to cut back a lot this year and just focus on things I enjoy, like writing code. So most of the year has been writing code, or I have done a couple classes and a couple conferences, but in Pluralsight videos. Mm-hmm. That all keeps me pretty busy.
I have very much appreciated your series recently that you've been doing on C# 6 features and also ES6 features.
Oh, yeah. So I'm looking at both of those. ECMAScript 6, actually, I think is very interesting. So, you know, the products that I've been working on, one has been around now for 14 years. Is it 14? 12 years. And so whenever we're adding new features to this, it's very easy to think, you know, what are things going to look like in 5 years? Because a lot of the code there is already 10 years old, and you look at it and it's .NET 1.0 SQL data reader stuff. It's like, But I thought it would be interesting if, when adding some new features now, if we were to use Tracer and compile ES6 code into JavaScript code that will run in the browsers today, but then at least the code base is nice and sort of already a year or two in the future, so that 5 years from now it might look better.
Cool. And then also your C# 6 features have been interesting. Do you have a big, you know, favorite there? Like, you've done, property initializers and primary constructors?
I do. I like the combination of those two, the primary constructors and property initializers. You know, I have a tendency these days when I write a C# class, is the C# class usually has one constructor, and that gets any dependencies injected into it, and that primary constructor syntax along with the property initializers just works really well to write a class like that, because the class definition's a lot shorter, a lot clearer, I think, too. I also like the using static. I think that's going to open up some interesting ways to do fluent APIs now. That's where you can say, if there's a static class out there, you can have a using statement now that references that class name instead of just namespaces. You can say using, like, instead of using system, you can say using system.console. Console is a static class. And then you can invoke the static members of that class without using the type name. So for console, you could just do write line, and that's not that useful. But you can think about things like unit testing now. You don't have to write assert.r equal or it.is equal to or something like that. You can just write r equal or is equal or equal.
Mm-hmm. So back to the property initializers. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
No one expects.
Boom. He's here. What happened? Who let him in? Okay, property initializers. So we were having a discussion. It was probably on a Twitter, maybe Facebook or some point, about required properties and how you specify that, you know, they're required. I don't remember if it was Jeremy Miller or Glenn Block or somebody that I usually talk about these esoteric things with, we'd said that if a property on a class is required, that it should not have a public setter, and you should put it in the constructor, which doesn't lend itself to the property initializer kind of syntax that C# has now. And so I was going to kind of throw that out there and say, what are you guys' thoughts on that? I kind of see the point. because there's really no other way to say, hey, you know, you got to have this set on my class. And the best way to do that is to make them send a value when they're first newing it up. But on the other hand, it's kind of nice to be able to just, you know, not have to think about that stuff. And
see, I guess, I mean, there was a couple things that I was really hesitant about with this new syntax. First of all, I didn't find it particularly appealing the first time I looked at it. I had to actually write some code with it before I became the least bit comfortable. And certainly one of the first problems you'll recognize with C# 6 with this primary constructors is that you don't define a constructor body. Therefore, there's no way to validate parameters that are being passed into that constructor. There's a little bit of wiggle room mm-hmm. because when you do the property assignment, when you write the initializer, you could do something like assert.requal or assert.isNotNull or something and pass in a value that you got from the constructor and throw an exception if it's null. But I don't know. I haven't put it to great use yet. I have to see how this plays out. Mm-hmm. It is nice, though, to not have to have a setter on properties when you do this.
I guess that's kind of one of the primary benefits, right? You don't have to go through and write that all out.
Yeah, you don't have to write an explicit constructor. You don't have to say, you know, x equals the incoming x and y equals the incoming y. You don't have to have a setter. So there's less code, mm-hmm. certainly fewer characters, but you give up
more
a little
magic.
Bit, too. More magic. Yep.
Yeah.
See, some of that stuff is kind mm-hmm. of it doesn't enter into my field of vision simply because I'm so used to the Resharper code rush thing where you, okay, I declare, yep. you know, parameter, add field with initializer, boom, it's done. You know, I type AP and tab and it gives me a auto setting property or automatic property from a template.
Well, then it's a matter of time before. Yeah, I mean, if they do the same thing they did with var, I remember where Sharper was freaking out at me to change everything to var for a while.
Yeah.
So they may, you know what I mean? I'm not sure if they'll be yelling at you to change over to use primary constructors and stuff.
Well,
soon
that's
too.
The nice thing about Code Rush is that it doesn't yell at me to change things all the time. And I kind of go into, I've gone into the settings so many times and just, you know, don't give me code hints. Just tell me, you know, let me choose what I'm going to do.
Yep. I end up not using either just because, like, doing demos, it throws people off if you're using too many other custom things. But between the two, I always like Code Rush for that reason. I was like, okay, I get it, and you may be right, but I'm trying to do this, and you're yelling at me to do that. And, you know, like, I don't know. Felt like I was always under code review, like 24/7 code review.
I got enough people telling me how I'm supposed to write code. I don't need the tool doing that, too.
Kevin, what are you using for your primary operating system and editor these days?
OS X, my Mac, and Vim.
Yeah.
Or Mac Vim, to be specific. But, yeah.
Is anyone using Atom.io?
Oh, God. No. Did I say that out loud?
I've been playing with that lately.
I tried it. I honestly did. I even submitted patches to try to get it compiled under Windows correctly. But it was like hard coded to use VS 10 Express or via VC++ 10 Express. And I submitted patches and I never could get it building. And then finally some guy out there, you know, just got it all building right and started releasing binaries. And I tried it and it's just so slow. Compared to Sublime and in terms of speed, it's like from slowest to fastest, it's Atom, Sublime, and then Vim, really.
Yeah,
I've been using it more on Mac.
Having switched from Visual Studio to Vim, I have such a hard time going back to like a heavyweight IDE. It's just so painful for me now. Like even I played around with WebStorm.
Yeah.
Which is I still use sometimes as a great debugger for node work. Although mostly that's been replaced by Node Inspector now, which has gotten really good. But just loading up that heavyweight IDE is just so painful for me now. Vim has spoiled me in that regard.
And even like Atom feels heavy or like
I haven't actually played around with Atom, so I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't describe that as heavy, but. Yeah, and I understand they're like moving to React and like, you know, doing all kinds of optimizations to make the editing experience faster. So maybe there's hope there. But you know what, I've watched what happens with TextEdit also and with Sublime now, where it just sort of, you know, the people that are working on it just sort of check out and it just atrophies. And so it keeps me kind of coming back. Mm. You know, Vim is eternal. Vim will always be. It is.
It's a cockroach.
Kill it. And it's everywhere. It's on any operating system. So like that, even though it may not be quite as slick or as polished, as some of the other ones, it's just so solid and so reliable and so everywhere.
I guess what it is for me that's been made me interested in that is like it's cross-platform. The Atom is cross-platform and open source. And hopefully, you know, I mean, all that stuff depends on critical mass.
Right. Yeah. No, Atom probably has kind of the best chance of being something that I would try.
And I like how they're, you know, like general things about their architecture, like, you know, JSON for configuration and it's on WebKit and it's web, you know, kind of based, like building a package is relatively lightweight and stuff. It's more like building an extension for Chrome or something. So I don't know. I've been, you know, doing some more dev work on Mac and trying to find something I can bounce back and forth into, you know, That's been something I've liked more than Sublime or TextMate. Well, I was going to ask Kuhn what he's been up to, but he's not. He's like a ninja, jumped in and jumped out.
He's in, he's out.
So what have you been up to, John?
All right, so let me see. I've been doing some of these courses. There's this Microsoft Virtual Academy, and so they have this studio that's like a it's actually run by the studio I record in is run by this guy that worked in network TV, and so it's like a full-on kind of pro feel, you know. And they've got the three screens with the lights over the three cameras with the lights over them to show which is on, and they do, you know, two shot one, you know, and then close up and all this crazy stuff. And so
you have teleprompter.
Yeah, there's a teleprompter with the time remaining.
Cool.
And so that's.
So have you done like a Bill O'Reilly meltdown on set?
Not yet. I'm saving it. You know what I almost did last time was I was coming off a vacation and recording one, and I had as full of a beard as I get, and I was going to keep it for the first half of the day and then shave it during lunch and then see if anyone noticed. But it's kind of cool because we get like a very international audience. So like one of the first kind of things in the chat thing that came up was like, hello from Bangladesh. And I'm like, wow, this is cool. You know, I have no idea what time it is for this guy, but he's staying up all night long for this. So yeah, so we did like an intro to MVC. And then lately we did one that was intro to Bootstrap, or not intro. It was like more in depth. It was a full day of Bootstrap. So that was cool. I like got in past the, like we talked about, you know, the grid in depth, and then I covered mix-ins, you know, like decluttering your HTML by using the mix-ins, so I learned quite a bit there and prepping for it and stuff. So that was cool. The Rocks MVC book came out.
Oh, yeah.
High five to Scott. Okay, Scott. Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's good. And let me see. I was on the East Coast some, and I went over to Norway not working, which was kind of fun.
Wow.
Yeah. So my brother's band was invited to play at this festival, and so went over and played bass for an hour, and then that got me a trip over to Norway, and so that was fun.
Oh, right. Yep.
So I went over to the west coast of Norway, which Stavanger is. And I went to Pulpit Rock, and
awesome.
Yeah, so that was fun. Yeah.
And that was the one week where I was in the only week this year I've been in Southern California.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think what else. Yeah, I didn't mention I'm trying to keep up, you know, like in general I've done web stuff and like a lot of it's been ASP.NET, of course Windows Visual Studio, and since I'm on the Azure Evangelism team and they're, you know, also focus on, you know, Node and PHP and you know, Python and everything and including development on other platforms. And then ASP.NET VNext, next version of ASP.NET, is built so that you can develop and build and do everything on a Mac without ever even knowing that Windows exists or Visual Studio exists.
Okay. Slow down, Sparky. You're not evangelizing here.
Well, so I'm just saying. So I'm like having to like I've
you went into pitch mode.
Well, my point is
it's just automatic now.
It sure is. How can I get you to drive home today, Scott, in a brand new, fully buffed out?
Brand new ASP.
No, but so the thing is, I need to get like my dev chops up on Mac, and I've like gotten, I'm okay. I can get around on Mac. I can fix my father-in-law's computer when he messes it up. But I mean, like actually, you know, getting the muscle memory and being able to like actually build something relatively, you know, quickly is another thing. So that's been fun.
You'll know you've arrived when you can automatically type out the command to unzip a TGZ extension.
I think you just go to the store and buy an app, don't you?
Oh my god!
You know, it's so funny for me because I develop. I mean, I work all day on a Mac, and I also have a Mac at home. But I also still have this old Windows machine that I use for like, you know, like Quicken and stupid stuff like that. But I don't use it that often, and so every once in a while I'll come back to it, and it's like I kind of imagine what it's like for people who speak multiple languages to like switch languages, you know, like having to switch keyboard shortcuts, and it always takes me a minute to, you know, for my brain to reset into the old, you know, the old mindset.
You keep I'm Command C-ing close things, yeah.
Yeah,
but then eventually it does happen, and like then I can do it again. But there's always this like 5-10 minutes of like resetting the brain.
The hardest thing, I've got a loaner MacBook Air, and I think I'm going to break the screen because I keep poking at it because I'm just used to the touch screen now, and I'm like, go, what? Oh, it's broken. What's going on? And then I'm like, oh yeah, no. And then, but I'm like picking up the, you know, 3-finger swipe and 18-finger, you know, spin and all that stuff. So.
Okay, so do we want to go off the rails already?
Before we do that, we were talking about what we've all been up to lately. You got anything exciting and new you want to talk about?
Well, but along those lines, I got a new pooter. It's a Lenovo, one of the Ultrabooks. It's a 530. It's got the touch screen. It's 15 inches across, diagonal.
Those things are huge.
It's huge.
I don't think that's technically an ultrabook. Like ultrabooks are thin and.
Well, this is pretty thin.
Really? 530s.
Yeah. If you come to the, well, so it does have, it's got a terabyte of spinning rust in it. But if you come to the
6-pound ultrabook.
And it's really not that heavy, and it's not that big.
Okay.
But it is thicker than like the MacBook Air. I've got, you know, textbooks that are thicker than the MacBook Air.
So is it different? Is there a difference between the 530 and the? I'm thinking the W530, I guess.
No. This is the U530. I want to say.
Okay.
I think, yeah. So it's the way that I've been describing it is it's the consumer version of the Carbon.
Okay.
Simply because it's you know, it's not quite the same, but it's like it's got the same kind of chassis and the same kind of, it doesn't have the same kind of keyboard layout.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, no kidding. Mm-hmm. It does have it's got like a full size keyboard on it, but it's also got the NumLock and all that. It's interesting. The one annoying thing is that you have to hit the function key to tab the function things, and it doesn't have like an F lock anywhere on it that I've found yet. So like by default, that top row of function keys, which it does have a dedicated row, are like the hardware shortcuts. So like mute and airplane mode and yada and all that. And you know, I'm always using function keys, so I always have to remember to hit F function and then the key.
Really? There's no way to disable that?
There might be. I'm just not smart enough to find it. It took me a few weeks to figure out the keyboard backlit, even though there's a big, you know, key on the space bar with little like flashing lights coming out of it. It took me forever to figure, oh, that turns on the keyboard backlight. Oh yeah, okay. So I wouldn't lay the blame at Lenovo's feet. It's probably my fault.
I have the same issue on the Mac, where like I want an F key on the Mac, but they use the same thing. Mm-hmm. But it's easy to turn that off on the Mac.
Yeah, I'm sure there is somewhere, but like usually when they have a function key, they also have an F lock. So you just, I'm going to lock it in function key mode. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing obvious on here that says it's in.
Yeah, in the Carbon, you have to do that through an application.
Yeah, that might be the case here too.
You know, the I have the original Carbon X1, and then they came out with another second generation Carbon where they just really went crazy, and it's like these function keys that change.
Oh, they completely fouled up the keyboard. I could rant for hours about that.
Do you have the newer one?
I do.
I know people that have
I went
that.
Against my... Yeah. I was determined not to buy it. I ended up doing it anyway, and there are times when I'm so frustrated with this keyboard.
It's just kind of like the original Carbon was... I mean, I've got it. I love it. I mean, it really works well. It's smooth. And then I know people that have the newer one, and they're just like, they hate it, and they buy other keyboards to plug into it, and they're just like...
Yep. I mean, it's thin and light and stylish and feels really good, but the keyboard is so frustrating. So I locked it into function key mode, that adaptive keyboard across the top. But unlike a real keyboard, it responds to just very gentle swishes of the finger.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And if I'm in a lounge chair, or if I'm on a airplane or anywhere where my hands aren't spread out and they're kind of crunched up, I'm constantly brushing that function row and doing things like turning airplane mode on and off, turning screen display to the second display, just all sorts of ridiculous stuff. And that's where the hardware control keys are also. So if I lock it into function mode, I don't have a really easy way to go and like change volume or brightness. I have to tap a function area of that adaptive keyboard, which is really bad when you're in the office and you open up a link that has some blaring music on it. It takes like 5 seconds to shut that down.
It's just crazy.
So sad when companies feel like they need to, scare quote, innovate on the keyboard. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you did it so well for so long. Like, the Lenovo always had the best keyboards.
And there's no insert key. So using ReSharper, when you're using ReSharper, you used to alt insert. So now it's like now it's a 3-finger operation to do an alt insert.
Hmm. Wow. The only complaint I have about mine is that it's a full-size keyboard, but it also has the numeric keypad off to the right, so everything is shifted to the left from the center. So it's kind of weird to be typing over just to the left of the center of the keyboard. And it also kind of means that I'm constantly setting off that right-hand screen with the charms on it, because I'm always tapping on the right-hand side of the touchpad as I'm typing. And that just bugs me. It's like it's constantly something I'm doing. I get too far and it like boop, it pops out the little charms slider thing, and I'm like, okay, I gotta click somewhere to tell it I'm not in that window.
Wait, I'm confused. As you're typing, you're hitting the screen to
Because the no. So it's got the touchpad, and the touchpad's at the bottom.
Oh, right.
And since I'm kind of off to the, since I'm shifted to the left from where I'm sitting, because I'm sitting and my head and my body is oriented with the center of the laptop screen, but my hands are off just enough to the left so that I'm on the home row, you know, index fingers on F and J. But then that means that part of my palm is resting on the touchpad, and it'll set it off sometimes if I move around a little bit. You know, I've got it set to, you know, not respond to like palm rests and touches and junk like that. But sometimes I swipe it just enough, or if I'm having to go down, like if I want to like 2-finger scroll something, sometimes when I move my fingers down, it means that I'm just enough off to the right that I trigger that gesture that brings out the charm slider. And then, you know, it switches focus to that, and whatever I'm on stops working, and I have to, like, tap back in there. And this isn't like, it's not like, oh, twice a day this has happened to me. I'll sit down for, you know, an hour or so, and it'll happen like 20 or 30 times. And as far as I can tell, and I've asked and ranted on Twitter and everywhere else, there's no way to disable that charms slide out thing, because that's just it.
There's some things you can do to disable the touchpad while you're typing. There's an app called Touch Freeze. Mm-hmm. And then depending on the different whatever thing, that you can go into the Synaptics or whatever it is, and there's some kind of option to like disable it.
Yeah. So this also comes out when I'm just using it, like using the touchpad.
Oh, right.
So I just end up that my fingers are down there just far enough that I'm off to the right enough on the touchpad that it triggers that. So that's not necessarily a Lenovo problem. It's a Windows 8 problem in that, you know, I can disable the swipe to alt tab thing on the left there. And for a while, when my wife and I both got Lenovos, and for a while, every time we would try to mouse around using the touchpad, we ended up swapping alt tabbing, basically, because it had that swipe to switch apps stupid thing. Does anyone know what I'm talking
yeah.
about?
Yeah, you can swing it from the left. But, I don't even use the touchpad barely at all anymore. I do a little bit, but for the most part, I'm just touch the screen.
That was where I was saying we're going to get derailed, because everyone said, oh, once you have a touchscreen, you never go back. And the problem is I've had a touchscreen now, the only time I use it is when I'm on that main tile screen, which I almost never am because I boot to desktop, because most of the apps that I'm using are in desktop mode, mm-hmm. or when I'm playing Hearthstone, that game from Blizzard. It works great to be able to just tap on the card and like slide it and do whatever you need to do.
Yeah, I use it. I use it pretty much.
I don't think they designed it for touchscreen, but
yeah,
it's there and it works great. Other than that, I never use it.
I mean, it takes a little bit to get used to, but I use it for everything. Like I'll use it on web pages. I'll scroll up and down with it. I'll click links. I pinch and zoom with it on everything.
So I've noticed that when I try scrolling on the touchscreen itself, I end up, at least in Chrome, maybe this isn't as much of an issue in IE, but like it's like it thinks that my two fingers on there are trying to pinch and zoom, and so it's like zooming everything out and in all crazy all the time.
Yeah, you don't do two fingers to scroll. It's just one.
Yeah. I should have the freedom. That's kind of weird. So if I'm on the touchpad, I do two fingers to scroll up and down. On the touchscreen, I just use one.
Yeah.
But then sometimes, even when I'm trying to like scroll, it ends up selecting text. And I haven't found a really good way using the touchscreen to select a block of text. Like, hey, I want to copy this URL from the web page and paste it into something else. So I always end up using the touchpad to kind of, do the click select and then control C, control V. Mm. But
it is a little wonky to do that. I end up like tapping one word and it'll select it, and then you get the little grabby handles at the beginning and end of it, and you can slide those. But it's not super easy always to do. That is definitely something where I go to the trackpad more.
Two weeks ago, I put my Carbon into caps lock mode. The only thing is it doesn't have a caps lock key. I had to search the internet to figure out how to get it out of caps lock.
And how you got it there to start with.
So apparently double tapping the shift key.
Wow.
We'll put it in caps lock.
You know, that would have been a good time to go and...
Just like the iPhone. Yeah,
that would have been a good time to go and leave some comments on YouTube.
Caps lock. Yes. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking I'd go to the Lenovo forums and complain about this.
It's the sticky keys, control key, all over again. Anyone ever run into that where you hold the control key down and, you've enabled sticky keys? And, no, I went. I didn't do not.
Fortunately, at least on that, I think now when you do that, there's a checkbox or something when that thing pops up to say, never show me this again. Like, basically, like, no, I didn't want this and I don't ever want to deal with this again. Because it used to be like it just automatically enabled it. And you're like, what is going on?
Hang on. I guess I have one thing I want to say. Since we're complaining about keyboards, John, when next time you're in Redmond, mm-hmm. I want you to go to find the team that made the new Microsoft Natural Keyboard, the new wireless
I'm
one.
I'm typing on it right now.
Smack them upside the head for me.
You're not a fan.
Because those friggin' function keys are the absolute worst. Like, they ruined the keyboard with that. I was all excited when they announced that keyboard.
Yeah, so I do like the keyboard a lot to type on, and I just leave it in function key mode all the time. And so I don't use any of the other, like, is that what you're talking? There's a toggle at the top, right?
No, I'm talking about the little chiclety function keys, like how they're not real keys.
Oh, right, that too. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
It's horrible. Like, why would they do that on a full-size keyboard?
It all keeps coming back to people screwing with the function keys.
What is with the hate for the... I mean, it used to be the little... they'd screw up the arrow keys, mm-hmm. and they'd change it out of the, the common T position. Yeah, I mean, then we finally beat them down enough that they stopped doing that with the keyboards, but now they're, like, messing around with inserts and functions. We need to go back to those IBM Selectrics, the mechanical ones that make the big clicky-clacky sound. That's what we need to do.
Has anybody tried that code keyboard that Jeff Atwood worked with?
Yeah, I did. One of my coworkers bought it.
Do you have any thoughts?
It was, I felt okay, but I need a natural keyboard. Like, I can't use a non-natural keyboard anymore. So I was disappointed that they never put one out that was ergonomic.
I had the same thing. It looks beautiful. There's a lot of neat settings. There's a lot of really, nice hardware and thoughtful design and stuff. But I had something where my main Ergo keyboard broke for a week and I typed on a, old school keyboard, flat one. And I had all this wrist pain within a week. And I was like, oh, this is why I don't get wrist pain anymore. So I just can't even consider it.
Yeah.
I guess I like my keyboards like my cars. I don't need a lot of options, but I like the steering wheel to be in the same place and kind of the shifter in the same place. So I don't need, you can control all your multimedia functions. Oh, look, we've got this big thing in the middle that lets you scroll. Put the A key next to the S key.
Yeah.
QWERTY across the top and give me some function keys and just stop messing with it. Make it last long.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so what did I do this with my summer vacation? Oh, good. Hang on.
A lot of this, I'm guessing.
So what did I do? I did a lot of this.
Herding cat.
Exactly. We went on a couple of trips. One to a population of a town with a population of about 1,000, which was nice. It's in the upper part of eastern Washington, and we went horseback riding and fossil finding, and it was nice to be that far away from everything. But the hotel still had Wi-Fi, so that's all that matters, I guess. Tech-wise, I got moved from a project where we're on an MVC-based project, which is basically a single-page app, to supporting one and extending one that was written using monorail with Braille's as the view engine. Remember when we all thought that was a good idea?
Yeah, you've done that before. I remember you were on a monorail project, right?
Yep. So yeah, over last November, December, this was the same application. Oh. I guess I shouldn't have done a good job because they brought me back on to add more stuff to it. And so that one was just, we were adding just a little tiny piece of functionality and, that was fine. This time they wanted to add something more substantial. So we did the usual, Boy Scout kind of stuff. We're like, all right, can we update this thing to MVC? Can we get it on Razor? Can we at least use Razor as the view engine for monorail? No. Short answer, no. It certainly was possible, but not in the time frame that it would take to rewrite everything, mainly because this was written in the era of software craftsmanship. And so it was very craftsmaned up, and there were lots of opinions in the code. For example, this was back when everyone thought that it'd be great if things were readable by humans. So you had all these extension methods in C to add things like should be and to be this and the thing is this and all that, which is just awesome to debug through. There were so many views and subviews written in Boo using Braille's that it was time prohibitive to rewrite all of them in Razor.
This is like hipster .NET coding back in the day.
It's oh my gosh, exactly. They actually had an aggregate root, and the class name was aggregate root.
Go DDD. So
So I got into that and I was like, wait, what? And it was
ubiquitous language for the win.
I ended up just trying everything. We were just trying to update the version of Fluent and Hibernate they were using. But they were using another version of a custom in-house library that added a lot of extensions and helper methods to monorail. And everything was so tangled together via Castle and the dependencies that literally I tried for 5 days and another dev tried for 3 days just to upgrade to the latest Fluent and Hibernate. And we couldn't do it reliably because there was enough broken between the version of Fluent and Hibernate we were using, which was essentially 1.0, and the latest version. And so there were so many things that folks thought were a good idea back then that they were using, like custom constraints and custom types and all sorts of stuff in there. We just couldn't do it. So
I've gotten burned by this kind of stuff over the years, and I always kind of have this thing now where it's like, this makes an awesome blog post, but this is going to be hard to maintain and X number of years, and this just definitely seems like, you know, like, it's like, and all the time when I get these crazy support things that come across the ASP.NET, like, internal discussion lists, and it's like, the people that are always screwed are the ones that are like, yeah, we wrote our own X, you know, like, we didn't like how this works, so we wrote this new internal thing that extended off of this and has its own, you know, whatever, and or whatever it is, you know, and then it's just like, oh, dear. Yeah, you're screwed.
Well, yeah. And, well, 90% of our problems are due to strong naming in terms of updating everything, as are all problems in the .NET world. But a couple of cool things did come out of this.
Yeah, did can I ask, did you, one time when I was really stuck with something like that way back, I ended up using binding redirects in the web config?
Yeah, we tried that.
Oh, man. Yeah.
We even tried aliases. So we tried seeing if we could IL merge like stuff in and then use aliases and take it out of the global namespace. And like, no, we couldn't do it. We still ran into collisions. We tried everything short of emitting our own or rewriting the IL using that profiler API. Mm-hmm. We tried everything short of that. So it just came down to, yeah, we could, you know, we could probably fight our way through this, but you know, we're supposed to be done by August.
Yeah.
And it's June. So is it really worth it?
Right.
No. But one thing I did do is, we've kind of started, we've been evaluating MongoDB for use where I work because we've got SQL Server licenses, but we also have a lot of, and not necessarily unstructured data, but we have a lot of key value kind of lookup stuff as we're dealing with securities and funds and things like that where, hey, I've got this stock ticker. I want to get the current price, you know, or I want to get the last 30 days prices or blah, 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 things like that. So I started taking a couple of courses at Mongo University, which is interesting. We've also had a couple of people start adopting AngularJS at work. I'm not one of them because I'm working on the Monorail Rails site. But I did find a use for React.js. I started evaluating that and kind of looking at it, and I saw this as a nice way to add client-side functionality into an app that is a, you know, kind of a nightmare to work on. Being able to separate everything, I did go the JSX route, and I got Grunt Transforms working with React and with a Saki built script on TeamCity. So now when we run, it does npm install and then runs the grunt tasks and minimizes, concatenates the JavaScript and then does the JSX transforms to standard JS.
How does that work when you're developing? Because I looked at that a little bit, but that's, you can either do it at, you know, development time or run, you know, at build time.
Right. So they've got, you know, like grunt tasks and other things you can do to transform to JS for runtime or for basically for production.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, they have a client script JSX transformer that you can use in line. So the way that we've got it set up is we've got a, hey, if my environment is dev, then here's all the unminified scripts that we're using. All
right.
Including the JSX transformer. And then in our, when we link to the React script, we just, okay, if we're dev, then load the JSX. Otherwise load this. And so that combined with the React tools for Chrome worked really well. And then at, you know, build time on the CI server, we just go ahead and run the transform and use the standard, so it just becomes pure JavaScript, React JavaScript. I'm really digging React, especially in this kind of use case where we needed to add a dialogue to a page and the dialogue was going to let them, you know, interact with the page. So you can imagine trying to do all this through Boo and Postbacks and whatnot. It would have been a mess because VS doesn't even handle Boo anymore. It tries to reformat it, which then throws off the white space sensitive Boo, which would mean that our views would break just by opening them sometimes, opening and saving them. So that was interesting. We ended up using Vim a lot, actually, to edit the views, just because we didn't trust Visual Studio to not mess up our Boo view or our Brails view.
Mm.
But yeah, being able to just use React to kind of put this dialogue in there was really nice to have everything packaged up into one JS file. Mm. And, you know, that was kind of it. And it was, you know, so we had a component for the dialogue. We had a component for the select box in the dialogue. We had our own React class for the save button, which had its own, you know, save methods and cancel methods and everything else. And so I'm really, really starting to dig React for this.
You know, I've been hearing more and more about React lately. people seem to be getting into it.
I'm curious to see where it goes, like, as things are going on with web components, and, you know, there's work going on, like, with Angular as well on that. React is definitely, like, a different kind of take, but it's still, you're building out components with this virtual DOM kind of thing.
And that's really the biggest difference that I found between Angular and Ember and everything else is, Angular and Ember, they're kind of trying to be MV and C, where all React is caring about is the V. They specifically don't do two-way data binding. They don't, you know, out of the box, they don't have any of that stuff. It's just about creating components and wiring them up. And the virtual DOM diffing is really fast. It's really nice. So I've actually read more than one blog post about people using React with Angular or with Ember to render long lists of things or render lots of pages that have lots of elements on them because React is so much faster. And there was a presentation by one of the Ember core team members, and he said, yeah, we're going to be borrowing some things from React for the next version of Ember for sure. And I think, you know, the fact that it's fast and it's not trying to be a Swiss Army knife framework, you know, like all these other ones are, and that it's got the weight of Facebook behind it. So like all of Instagram is written in React. The comments and messaging on Facebook is written in React. So when people say, oh, well, you can't use that for big apps. Well, you can. You kind of can, yeah. I think that React's going to be something to look for in the next few years, even more so than Angular and Ember and the other ones. And that's pretty much, I mean, the rest of it's all boring, you know, family stuff. Just the kids are out of school, and you're like, oh, now we got to entertain these little things all day.
Do you want to do the lightning round thing?
Well, I feel like we got to talk about the Apple stuff today.
Yeah, so the first question for the lightning round is anyone getting the new iPhone or a watch? Kevin.
I would like to. I don't know that I can justify it. The watch seems very – I actually really like the idea of the watch. But it seems very iPad 1-ish to me, like very, you know, V1. And my guess is, you know, in a year or two, it's going to be a lot thinner, a lot, you know, more svelte. And because right now it looks pretty damn thick when you look at it sideways. So I don't know. Probably not. I don't know that I could justify it, but I actually wouldn't mind trying it out.
But it's not.
I am one of these. Sorry, I was saying
it's not something that would happen in the next week, right?
Well, the watch you can't buy until 2015. The watch is not available immediately.
Yeah.
I was going to say I am one of these old school people. You know, me being old and all, that actually wears a watch still, and so I'll be interested to see whether, like, does this bring the watch back into vogue with, you know, the youngsters who mostly don't wear them, or will it just fall flat because, you know, because that whole demographic is kind of moved beyond the watch?
John?
Yeah, no. I mean, so the iPhone 6 is interesting. I'm happy to see some things like NFC and the charging. They are doing cool stuff with the camera. I don't think people like the high speed photography, what they're doing with the focusing looks cool. I was surprised it's 8 megapixel. I mean, I know that's decent, but I mean, I would have thought they would bump that up some. But overall, the phone, you know, looks nice. But nothing, you know, like shocking. I mean, bigger, but I think everyone kind of expected that. The watch, like Kevin's saying, it does look 1.0. It does look nice. I mean, it seems like a pretty well thought out UI. In terms of navigation and the, you know, the crown for zooming and moving around. So it seems like they really kind of thought the UI through pretty well. And I forget there were some things like responses where, you know, you have a text from so-and-so. Did you decide between this or that? And it would automatically put up a prompt between those things, you know, on the screen. I thought that was really sharp. So, I mean, some neat things there. And honestly, I went from there to looking at the Moto 360, which is also, I think the Moto 360 looks a lot better. We haven't heard anything on battery life on the Apple Watch. Interestingly, not called the iWatch. So, but since it's so big, I'd expect it's got a honking battery in there. But I haven't worn a watch. I used to love watches. I haven't worn a watch for a long time. And so I actually spent some soul searching time today looking around and thinking, and of course there's not really a great watch that works with the Windows phone right now. There's this Krios. I've got an Agent watch on order from Kickstarter whenever that happens. And then there's
Hanselman probably has a few spot watches he can sell you.
But, then I was like, well, does it do this? Does it do that? And then honestly, later I was kind of like, I don't know what I'd do with it all that much. It would be a little gadget that I'd play with. I don't know that I'd actually do too much with it. So I don't, but I am happy to see like that moving forward. Cause like in 5 years, watches are going to be cool. Like They're going to nail it. And I feel like, there's some pretty solid stuff going on with the Android Wear and all the stuff they're building out, and then Apple getting in the game. It would be nice if Microsoft ever did something here again. I don't know, but I'd like to see that move forward. So I was happy to see some kind of general things. Not super happy about the payment thing, just because it's going to be another you can't buy, I don't like all the separate standards. I like the idea of MagSafe charging on the MacBook is nice. It's just way ahead of, what other chargers are. Okay, great. That's awesome. Make your own connector. But then there were some other things it would have been nice for me to see if they had a different charger that used for the watch instead of separate, proprietary one, go with Key or PowerMat, one that's already out there and there's chargers all over the place and they already have them, they're putting them in at Starbucks and stuff like that. So I get that, there's this part of the thing, but I wish that there was a little, and I have a little bit of hope there because Apple has been doing stuff where they have been opening up APIs. The last Apple event before this one, there was a lot of the big thing I took away from it was open platform, opening up the API, making it easy for people to get in and interact between things. Normally things that were pretty closed down. So yeah, but Scott Kuhn's definitely buying them both.
No. Actually, I have an iPhone 5C, and I've been looking it in, looking at other Android phones, and I'm kind of, the way that I'm using the phone, I could easily switch to Android, and it wouldn't bother me. So I probably won't be getting the iPhone Maxi when it comes out. As far as the watch goes, for Father's Day, I got a Pebble watch. My wife bought me a Pebble watch. Remember those when they were cool 6 months ago? And so I've been wearing it, and I tweeted this earlier and people didn't get what I meant. But I said that the biggest advantage for a smartwatch is acting as a smaller second display for your phone, basically. So if I have an appointment, it vibrates on my wrist. I don't have to take my phone out of my pocket and look at it. If I get an incoming text or a message from someone on my VIP list, it buzzes, displays the message right there. I don't need to be able to surf on my watch. I can start and stop the music, but if I'm going to be doing that, I'm going to be plugging the headphones into my phone, so I'm going to have my phone there anyway. I can start and stop it there. There certainly are some, there's stuff like the weather apps, which just basically get the weather from your phone and display it on your watch. That's one of the nice things about the Pebble is that it's got a really good battery life. I'll get 2 or 3 days out of a charge, even with notifications and illumination on. The watch faces are kind of cool. It's interesting to see innovation in clocks, like the way that they display the time. the iWatch was kind of too little too late. People were really excited about it when the iPod Nanos came out and they released all those watch bands so they could put the Nano in there. And people loved that idea. But now it's kind of, what do I need this for? My phone gets bigger. My watch gets bigger. Why is everything bigger? I thought small was better. So I don't see myself getting an Apple Watch simply because the Pebble does everything that I need, really.
But, Scott, how are we going to send our heartbeats to each other?
Our YOLOs or YOs? I don't know. I think you can still do it.
Maybe.
Oh, that's right. It does record your heartbeat and check. Yeah. Whatever. They've got pedometer apps for Pebble. I don't care about that. That doesn't affect me as much. It seems to me, and I don't know, but I don't know how Kevin or you guys that use Macs more on a frequent basis, seems to me that kind of everything has kind of gone downhill since Steve Jobs died. You know, it's not like Apple's hurting for business or anything, but it's just like the little things, like in the OS and some of the updates, and like my phone crashes a lot more than it used to, I've noticed, or apps will crash on it more. The kind of stuff they're coming out with, you know, it doesn't seem all that, you know, interesting, I guess. Like, oh, look, it's the iPad mini. It's an iPad, but smaller. Oh, look, it's the iPad Air. It's the iPad, but thinner. And the same with kind of the iPhone iterations. I mean, coming out with the A4 and the A5 chips was interesting and fascinating, but the rest of it's just kind of been this Moore's Law race in terms of how many pixels can we cram on there and how fast can we make things go.
Well, and tiny. There's definitely been a lot of shrinking. You know what I mean? Like keep things super thin and all that. I'm not sure if that's fair, and I've thought that over the years too, but I mean, there's a limit to what you can do on a phone with the current technology and battery life and all that kind of stuff. And they're definitely kind of pushing that engineering wise. And then the watch is definitely, I mean, it could have been earlier. That's definitely something like, and maybe that's some how I'll agree. I mean, like the watch is a new product for them, totally new product. But then given that it is later, like compared to the Moto 360, not necessarily much better. Okay. Maybe I do agree.
Well, and it's like, you know, like the last few software updates for, you know, like iOS 7 wasn't that revolutionary. It just made everything kind of flat and white. And then there were a few updates after that that kind of stuttered, like, oh, we got this. Oh, nope, it's got a bug. So we got to release another point release, you know, a few weeks after that. And, you know, and I'm trying to imagine that kind of thing happening when Jobs was alive without people getting fired. I don't know. Maybe I'm overestimating how much effect he really had on the final product, but it does seem like there's a lot more, like the quality has slackened a bit under Cook. Maybe that's just like a bias I have about it, but you know, I think the Macs are fine machines, but I also, like I before I bought the Lenovo, I'd kind of thought, do I want to go the Mac Air? Do I want to go with the MacBook? You know, I didn't, the SSD question didn't really come into mind because I'm like, you know, I'm okay with it taking a few extra seconds if I've got, you know, a ton of storage space. And what it came down to was, it was just like, if I'm going to run a Unix or a POSIX type system, I'll just go ahead and put Ubuntu or Slack or, you know, Red Hat or something else on my Lenovo rather than go with a MacBook and get kind of the, you know, a Unix system with the pretty desktop, and given the tools that I use and the kind of the web world I live in, a Mac didn't offer that much of a benefit over Lenovo. And maybe that's just like people still buy MacBooks and they go through and wipe out OS X and put, you know, Windows on there, or they put, you know, Windows in Parallels or VMware or whatever and run it. And I've always thought, well, you could get more machine for less and still get the POSIX running, you know, Ubuntu or whatever you wanted to and still boot into, you know, Windows if you want to for a lot less money and get a lot more machine out of it.
There's definitely a lot fewer differences now. Like I noticed going back and forth between, you know, I mean, we use the browser more. There's a lot, just operating system wise, I don't really feel this jarring thing going between, you know, Windows and Mac and Ubuntu. And then also like developer wise, like, you know, Node, NPM, all the dev tools kind of, like, it didn't take me long. I just repaved this MacBook Air, put Yosemite on it, and then grabbed the stuff. But then NPM, you know, is there, and Bower and Yeoman and Grunt, and, you know, it's like, yeah, it's all the same stuff, you know. But then there's occasionally stuff where, no, you must have a Mac to do this thing. But it's, I guess I find it rarer.
Well, that's kind of what I ran into trying to build Atom, was that, you know, if I built it under Linux, it had GCC and it just used GCC and it all worked. But, you know, when I was on Windows, they were kind of out of their element. So they were trying to hard code a path to the VCC compiler and they're not VCC, but Visual C++, you know, compiler. And then it was sniffing for versions, which meant that, you know, you had this branch for three different versions of Visual Studio and, It was just kind of a mess. And I find that a lot with NPM. I've grown to hate NPM, really. It's kind of like my nemesis. It's such a...
And ding, ding, ding.
Such a... Oh, yeah, we are way off the lightning round.
Piece of a lightning round.
Just rambled. Welcome back.
We just have to have another discussion show that starts off talking about NPM. That's what we have to do.
Oh, my God.
Start scheduling that now, John.
Right. What was the question? No, I'm not going to get an iWatch.
Me either.
All right.
I didn't even know it wasn't available till next year.
It was weird that they didn't say a word about battery life. Like, not even nothing. I mean, they did say, like, you can enjoy this all day. And some people are like, of course, that means it lasts 18 hours. And it is big. So if there's, I got to imagine.
Well, they might have, John, but my Chinese is kind of rusty.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. By the way, that is the whole live stream debacle was really embarrassing. I mean, that was really, really terrible.
Yes.
I never got to see any of it live. Like, it never worked for me at all.
I had two Macs trying to work with it. I have my own Mac Mini. I have this MacBook Air. And then I ended up, somebody tweeted the link to just like, hey, you can open this link up on VLC on Windows. And it ended up that was worked better than the other two. But yeah, it was kind of like, how, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know whether that's – I mean, I've seen past ones, and they were fine. So I don't know whether they use somebody different or there's just so much more popular.
Back when Jobs was alive, this is what I'm saying.
No. Even last year, it was, or even the iOS 8, like the Apple Dev Conference stuff was just way, 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 way better. So it was – yeah, that was really terrible. I'm sure heads are going to be rolling over that one.
Are we done with the lightning round?
Yeah, those guys can go work for Channel 9.
Hey, Channel 9 gets their stuff done. I mean, I can't remember a messed up Channel 9.
Dude, it's like a professional broadcast television station over there. It's not Robert Scoble running around with a video cam anymore with this little flip.
Yeah, but on the other hand, they probably don't ever get the kind of scale of viewership that.
But you know, then you know, people can always be snarky. But you know, I know somebody else said on. You know, somebody else at Microsoft's like, hey, we got the Olympics broadcast. What's going on over there? You know, it is true that it's high scale, but it's like people do this stuff all the time. Like there's live video streams with lots of people. Yeah, but the Chinese was a nice touch. Is K Scott still there? What kind of lightning round is this?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I tried to conclude the lightning round and then gave up and was going to take a little nap.
All right, do we need to let K. Scott go to bed?
Yeah, I need to get to sleep and find out what MongoDB will deliver tomorrow.
I have one tiny question on that MongoDB. Remember when we talked to that guy about CouchDB?
Oh, yeah.
I just know his Twitter handle, which is hard to – but Max, right? Was it Max? But mm-hmm. And it did sound like there were some like nice benefits over Mongo, but yet everyone's still using Mongo. What's going on there?
Marketing.
All right.
I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I've thought about it a lot about, you know, what to move from MongoDB. But it just, yeah, hasn't happened. And I will say that the company behind Mongo is pretty aggressive at finding people who are using Mongo or thinking about using Mongo and, calling them and trying to, you know, self-support contracts and training and this and that and this and that.
Yes, they are. We got a full court press from them too. Oh, has anyone used the Document DB on Azure?
No, it's on my list.
Just yeah, I haven't. I still haven't put anything of substance on Azure. I feel bad.
Honestly,
I don't know why.
Yeah, I haven't. I mean, I'm familiar with what it does and stuff, but I haven't really, you know, like used it in anger. So
yeah, ask me in a couple months.
You'll have 10 videos detailing every aspect of it.
It seems like Postgres is eating the world these days. Like now, especially now they have the JSON stuff. It's like Postgres is it.
Somebody said that as soon as Postgres can do parallelism, it's over. Postgres will win. Or Postgres or Postgres. I call it Postgres, I guess.
Postgres. Yeah.
I don't know. But they said everything else. I mean, it can already eat MySQL's lunch in terms of performance and reliability. And you know, once it gets over that little hump, nobody wants to use Oracle because. Just it doesn't matter how good they are. No one wants to sell their soul.
Mm-hmm.
On that note.
All right. Wrap it up.
I think that's the show.
Okay. All right. That's all the time we have. I forgot I introduced it. So what is it? Policy?
By the power vested.
Yes. I now conclude this, podcast and, thank you. May you have a very pleasant tomorrow.
Look, the cat is fine.
No,
go. She hasn't seen the cat all day, she says, and she's worried. I just saw him. Awesome.
This is professional podcasting at its finest, ladies and gentlemen.